In today's paper, I'm examining two related questions. The first, how does pro-Nicene exegesis interpret New Testament verses containing the word monogenes in relation to 4th century Trinitarian debates, specifically eternal generation? Secondly, an investigation of the term monogenes and how it functions in those pro-Nicene texts. That is a question about the use of those verses and a question about the term itself. A few preliminaries then. There are 9 verses in the New Testament containing the word monogenes. 4 of these are not direct references to the second person of the Trinity, 3 in Luke and 1 in Hebrews, leaving us with 5 Johannine usages, all referring to the second person of the Trinity. John 1:14, 18, 3:16, 3:18, and 1 John 4:9. Undoubtedly, these 5 appear to form the basis for later patristic use of the term. Secondly, by eternal generation, I mean the doctrine that the Son and Father exist as divine persons eternally and eternally in a relationship of fatherhood and sonship, such that the Son has an eternal origin in the Father, termed generation, precisely because it is a Father-Son relationship. This position argues that the distinguishing characteristics of the persons is and only is their eternal relations of origin. Thirdly, at least in today's paper, I use the term pro-Nicene, in a sense derived from Lewis Ayres, and use it to restrict my scope of authors to 5, Athanasius, Basil, the 2 Gregories, and maybe Hilary. The rationale for this is that these authors are unquestionably considered pro-Nicene and theologically significant in terms of these doctrines, are considered to formulate some form of eternal generation. The corpora of all 5 are large enough to support a worthwhile analysis, and it means I don't need to talk about Augustine. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the meaning of the word monogenes, which was not originally the focus of my paper, but became a sub-focus and a source of recent contention. In one sense, and if you look at the texts, how you translate monogenes, I don't think impacts how you see it operating in the 4th century. But debate in recent times has focused around 2 variants. Position A, that monogenes normally means one of a kind or unique, and marks an individual as distinct or sole in its class, without any reference to generation or descent. Position B, that monogenes normally means only begotten, and is lexically related to the ideas of generation and descent. This dichotomy resembles the position taken recently by Kevin Giles, who insists that monogenes means one of a kind, but that the uniqueness of that one of a kind is filled in with the content of eternal generation. The other position is typified by Charles Lee Innes, who has a chapter in this very recent book, arguing that it does indeed mean only begotten. Etymologically, there's no question that monos and genos are the kind of etymological roots of this word, and that it has 2 major usages, one referring to an only child, the other to only one of its kind or unique. One of the problems has been the suggestion that monogenetos would be a better Greek word for only begotten, suggested by Moulton and Milligan. The only problem being that this term is unattested in Greek, and it seems a little perverse to tell ancient Greeks what words they should have had. So I did what any good philological scholar did. I started analysing every occurrence of monogenes in Greek literature and epigraphic and papyrological evidence so far up till the 1st century. You can see some of this laid out in Table 1. So in 85 references in TLG, about 68% of these refer to a person, a son, daughter, child, human or divine, and they refer to that person as an only child. On occasion, these persons are not technically only children, but are treated as such. And in one particular case, Megasthenes in the 4th century BCE refers to an only daughter in contrast to many sons. Other categories of usage are much rarer and more easily addressed. Referring to an animal or plant, the word means only one of its species. You find this in Theophrastus for certain trees, and in 1 Clement talking about the phoenix. In philosophical texts, referring to the universe or cosmos as a uniquely generated and sole existing entity, and in grammar referring to one kind across all forms. Monogenes can certainly mean one of a kind, but when applied to persons, it seems to refer consistently and overwhelmingly to an only child. This is also the case throughout the New Testament. The occurrences in Luke are unambiguous. The occurrence in Hebrews refers to Isaac as an only child, which is also the way Josephus refers to Isaac and suggests that it is a theological point being made that Isaac is the only child that matters. Given that every other instance of monogenes in relation to a pairs, huios, thugate, or other child-related term designates a real or supposed only child, it requires a particularly stubborn disregard for linguistic evidence to insist that John has coined a novel meaning for the term and expects his readers to understand it. This is why Kevin Giles is wrong. Monogenes refers to an only child, not to a unique one that is filled in with the content of being a child. It's also why Bart Ehrman is wrong about John 1:18, that it could not be monogenes theos and had to be corrected because monogenes theos cannot be understood. It can be understood. The God who is the only child, a usage that I'll explore a little bit further. In relation to Ayn's very recent chapter, I would say my points of disagreement are three. One, that he insists on using the term only begotten, throwing an emphasis on begotten that is not there in the English phrase, only child. Only begotten is not a word or phrase that we use in English. I have an only child, not an only begotten. Secondly, he seems to conflate definitions with explanations. Of course, when the fathers in the 4th century explain what monogenes means, they talk about a begotten son because all children are begotten. This does not amount to a definition of the term. Thirdly, in his conclusion, he suggests that the five occurrences of the term in the Gospel and First Epistle of John thus provide part of the exegetical basis for the traditional doctrine of the eternal begetting or generation of the Son, which is in turn a crucial linchpin for the pro-Nicene doctrine of the Trinity. As you'll see in the second part of my paper, that's not true. Going on then to data and method, this is what I did to survey these 4th century authors. First, I used Bible Index to compile a list of all references to the 5 Johannine verses across those authors. You can see this laid out in Table 2. At first, it looks like a lot of references, but as you'll see, this is misleading. Secondly, and you don't have a table of this, I ran a TLG search for the Lemma of Monogenes across the authors. In Nyssa, you find 641. In Gregory of Nazianzus, only 27, thankfully. Basil, 280, and Athanasius, 287. Again, this high number of frequencies is a little misleading. Thirdly, I ran a search on Unigenitus in Hilary, which yields 272 results. 186 of those are in De Trinitate. I also ran a search of Unicus, trying to correlate it with filius or other terms, and there's hardly any. Very interesting in terms of the translation of that term and in connection to Adam's paper. So then I started trying to read all these references. I'm over halfway, and I went looking where you would expect things to be. That is, I chose significant doctrinal polemical texts, not minor letters. I'll get to them later. And so in terms of what I have found and not found, here we go. What pro-Nicenes don't do. It's of course quite difficult to prove negatives. To demonstrate that no text anywhere does something requires an exhaustive analysis of every single one. That's the only inductive method that can exclude all possibilities. And yet even at this stage, I'm confident that there are three things these authors do not do. Firstly, they do not exegete these verses in doctrinal polemical context. That is, they do not attempt to give an account of the meaning of the verse, per se. Secondly, the number of references is misleadingly high. And thirdly, they do not base their doctrine of eternal generation on these texts. To demonstrate, let me run you through some of the absence of these terms. Athanasius refers to these verses 90 times across his corpus. 6 in Ad Serapion, none of them are relevant. De Decretis has 12 references, 2 are actually Eusebius, only 3 are of particular interest. Contra Arianos contains 38 references, but 35 of these are to John 1:14, and all but one of those 35, so 34 of them, are about the Word made flesh, not monogenes. Only the discussion in 262 and to some lesser extent in 259 actually involves some theological weight being put upon these texts. Basil refers to the verses 29 times, only 4 times in Contra Eunomium, all of them references to John 1:14 and the phrase glory of the monogenes. None of them involve an exegesis of the phrase. Basil instead seems to use it as a set phrase emphasizing the glory and so the blasphemy of Eunomius against that glory. 6 references in On the Holy Spirit, 5 of which place no particular weight on the term. Gregory of Nyssa refers to these verses 241 times. However, this number is deeply misleading because Nyssa uses the phrase homonogenes theos to designate the second person of the Trinity, much like we use the phrase God the Son. This is listed as an allusion or reference to John 1:18, but he rarely discusses that verse per se. Gregory of Nazianzus only offers us 27 references. 10 of those are in his poetry, 4 in the theological epistles, which are all to the Word made flesh, not monogenes. 13 appear in his orations, of which only 2 come close to being expositional and relevant to our argument here. Lastly, Hilary has 82 references to the Johannine texts. 31 of them are in his tractates on the Psalms, 5 in his commentary on Matthew, 4 in De Synodis, and 35 in De Trinitate. But the references in De Synodis are all in relation to the Credo Sumium. Winigenitus doesn't appear in this text at all. Our main interest is probably then De Trinitate, but 24 of those references focus on elements not directly related to monogenes, talking either about the Word made flesh, in the bosom of the Father, or no one has ever seen God. That leaves 11 references that might appear relevant. Summarising then, the actual space spent on interpreting, explaining, or building a case from the Johannine monogenes texts is, relative to the number of references, small, especially in doctrinally oriented texts. My second point is connected to the first, and really an application of the same set of data. Once you eliminate all references that are not the author themselves, but someone being quoted, B, that do not contain monogenes at all, or C, are not actually a reference to the verse but a use of a title, the number drops from 469 remarkably. Thirdly, and probably most difficult to prove, no passage that I have read so far indicates that pro-Nicenes develop, build, found, or establish their understanding of the Son's eternal generation upon either an exegesis of these Johannine texts or an understanding of monogenes strictly in generational terms. Understanding monogenes as an adjective corresponding to only child makes best sense of the term both in its 1st century and its 4th century context. By turning to the key passages in which pro-Nicenes do make use of monogenes, this negative finding will be thrown into sharper relief. What then do pro-Nicenes do? Firstly, they use monogenes as a denotative or absolute term to distinguish the person of the Son from the person of the Father. 2, they occasionally offer a definition or explanation of monogenes as a term. 3, they interpret monogenes as supporting the unique quality or character of the Son's sonship, which in turn supports eternal generation. An important nuance. Firstly, the denotative use. Beginning with Nyssa and this denotative use, I mean the use of the term to distinguish the second person of the Trinity, analogous to the phrase God the Son in English. This is overwhelmingly the most common usage throughout Gregory Nyssa's corpus, as demonstrated in text 1 from Contrinomian 3.1. Even our opponents agree that the God overall is the Father of the monogenes, in fact and in name. They also refer to the monogenes God, who is from the Father, as begotten, because he originated by begetting. This is also the use found in Ad Oblabium, Ad Simplicium, and other works. It also accounts for Basil's use in Contrinomium and in On the Holy Spirit. Similarly, this denotative use is found in an important passage in Gregory of Nazianzus, Oration 31. Gregory is articulating that the difference in names is due to their mutual relations one to another. Thus, the very fact of being unbegotten, begotten, and proceeding is the basis for identifying the three persons as Father, Son, and Spirit. Gregory is clear that eternal relations of origin are the constitutive markers of Trinitarian personhood. He then uses the term monogenes towards the section end. This is text 2. For neither is the Son the Father, for the Father is one, but he is what the Father is. Neither is the Spirit the Son, because he is from the Father, for the monogenes is one, but he, that is the Spirit, is what the Son is. The three are one in divinity, and the one is three in properties. This denotative usage is not alien even to Hilary, who sometimes uses unigenitus in such a denotative sense. For example, in 12.52 of De Trinitate, God was never without his word, power, wisdom, the unigenitus God, my Lord Jesus Christ. In a few key places, the pro-Nicenes do offer an account of the term monogenes, which A, demonstrates an understanding of the term as only child, B, that it is the unique and genuine status of sonship that contributes to the idea of eternal generation. But neither the particular term or the Jahayan texts that enforces this. Text 3, this is Gregory in Oration 30. But let's go on then to the names of the Son, which is where our argument set out from. For it seems to me that he's called Son because he is identical to the Father in relation to essence, but also because he is from him. Next, Monogenes, not because he alone is from him and is alone, but because it is also in a unique manner, not as bodies. Gregory is engaged in explaining what names are proper to God as God and which names are proper to the persons distinctly. Firstly, huios, which he understands to be an expression of identical essence and of a generative relationship. And because, I suspect, Gregory considers huios a more primary title than those that follow. Then he uses monogenes to expand upon the manner of the Son's sonship. The negation here, not because he alone is from him and is alone, is almost certainly an anti-non-Nicene or an anti-anti-Nicene writer. For example, text 4 on your handout, Gegenemenon de monogene, monon ek monu tu patros, from the Creed of Sirmium 359. Within that non-Nicene understanding, monogenes indicates the only one brought forth from only one source. This is similar to the argument of Eunomius in his first apology, which Basil addresses in his Contra Eunomium 2.20. Text 5. For monogenes designates in common usage not the one coming from a sole entity, but the sole entity that is begotten. Basil's comment appears to be a strong claim to understand monogenes in generative terms. But it's perfectly logical to interpret or explain monogenes in generative terms without requiring generation to be to the forefront of the meaning of monogenes. This is reinforced by the fact that Basil goes on to argue that Eunomius' usage from a sole source would render every other normal or common use of monogenes incorrect. His example in text 6. Not even Sarah was a mother of a monogenes child, in that she alone did not produce him, but with Abraham. And if your opinions prevailed, the whole world would have to relearn again that this name is indicative not of a solitariness in relation to siblings, but an absence of co-procreators. So in fact, Basil's further reference here undermines using the earlier passage to support only begotten as a good translation, by making clear that in common usage, the term's main and to the front meaning is the lack of other siblings. Of course, a monogenes is begotten, genethes, because every child is genethes. This does not require only begotten to be itself the definition of monogenes. Going back to Nazianzus then, his interpretation in Oration 30.20 is that it refers to the manner of generation, that it is unique, and that uniqueness he qualifies is not as bodies. To put Gregory's reading in a broader theological context, the argument for eternal generation seems to go like this. One, that the second person of the Trinity is genuinely, truly a son. Two, that the sonship consists in being identical to the Father in essence and derived from the Father. Three, that other uses of son applied in the scriptures to sons of God are figurative or adoptive, not genuine. And four, that the manner of generation is purified of earthly, passionless begetting. Passionful. Gregory's understanding of monogenes supports this, in that the unique manner of generation distinguishes the son's generation from bodily generation, but upholds that he is truly and genuinely a son, and so supports his understanding of the term huios, while his status as an only child supports the fact that this is unique, not figurative or adoptive. Going on then to Athanasius, in a number of passages he gives insight into how he understands monogenes. Perhaps most pertinent is the passage from Against the Arians 2.62 in the context of his verbose counter-exegesis of Proverbs 8. This is text 7 on your handout. But if he is also called firstborn of creation, but not as if he were brought to the level of the creatures, and is called firstborn as first of them in relation to time, for how, whereas he is monogenes, but it is because of the word's condescension to the creatures, in relation to which also he became brother of many. For the monogenes is only monogenes, there being no other siblings. But the firstborn is called firstborn on the basis of other siblings. This dovetails nicely with what Adam was talking about in terms of primogenitus and unigenitus. Athanasius contrasts the terms monogenes and prototokos indicating that they have a different frame of reference. Monogenes, though, indicates a lack of siblings. Prototokos must be understood in relation to siblings, even if there aren't any yet. We talk about an only child with no expectation of others, a firstborn child if others are expected. But Athanasius does more than this. He relates prototokos to the sun's relation to other creatures, and in particular to the incarnation and the economy. Monogenes is an absolute eternal term applied as proper to the father, as he goes on in the passage, relating the son to the father in a way not shared by others. There is only one proper word, wisdom, and son of the father, so too only one proper monogenes. For the sake of time, I've left out Athanasius' references in De Decretis, partly because they're long. But in all of them, he's arguing that monogenes reinforces the fact that the son's sonship is both unique and genuine. So then, let's turn briefly to Hilary, who is a special case. It's been argued that Jerome is largely responsible, or to blame, depending on your take, for translating monogenes as unigenitus rather than unicus. And this is all the source of our troubles in the East, in the English tradition and the West. I'm not sure we should be so harsh on Jerome. I'm not sure what other good options he had except to stick with unicus, which loses some of the sense of only child, and yet would avoid the problem of the weight placed upon the genitus stem. Nonetheless, two passages in Hilary deserve our particular attention because they demonstrate both that Hilary is prepared to use unigenitus in the absolute sense as a distinguisher, and two, that because Hilary is operating Latin and operating with his genitus stem, he's operating with a much stronger notion of generation being inherent to the word. In the first of these two passages, 4:33, text 8 on your handout, he uses it to denote God the Son as uniquely God in a way that God the unbegotten is not. In fact, there can be only one God unbegotten, and likewise only one God begotten. Quote, God is to be glorified by the angels of God, for as he says, for I am the Lord, and there is no God beside me, for he is God unigenitus, and the name unigenitus admits no partner to it, just as unoriginate does not accept a partner in that respect alone that it is unoriginate. He is one from one, you see, neither is there any other unoriginate God except God unoriginate, nor is there any other unigenitus God except God unigenitus. Each, therefore, is one and single, obviously, in their individual quality of unoriginateness and origin. And thus each is the one God, since between one and one, that is, one from one, there is no second nature of the eternal divinity. He goes on in book 6 of De Trinitate to expound John 1:18. In particular, he's attempting to rebut the idea that son is an adoptive term. Quote, let him speak therefore with his customary voice. No one has ever seen God except the unigenitus Son who is in the Father's bosom. The guarantee of the nature did not appear sufficiently set forth unless of his distinguishing characteristic and external strength were added by signifying that distinction. Beyond Son, then, he adds the name unigenitus, utterly cutting off the suspicion of adoption. For the nature of unigenitus assures the truth of the name of Son. Here, I think, is one of the clearest passages in which a pronicene father expounds one of the texts and explains why unigenitus is added. He goes on in 6:40 to explain and expound that unigenitus should not be interpreted, as his opponents do, to mean perfect and filius to be a cipher for a creature, but to be understood in their own proper terms. He concludes, 6:40, here is his own genuine sonship, truth, not creation or adoption or pretense. From this is the proof of his love and delight that he gave his son, his own son, his unigenitus. In conclusion then, pro-Nicene usage of monogenes texts and the term monogenes exhibits four main consistent features. Firstly, every occurrence of monogenes can be understood in terms of the only child meaning suggested earlier. This is explicitly so in Basil's Contrinomian 2, where he gives it as the common usage of the term, and in Athanasius' Contra Arianos 2:62, where he states that a monogenes is only so with an absence of siblings. Secondly, I've illustrated, if not exhaustively demonstrated, that homonogenes, sometimes homonogenes theos, is often used in an absolute sense to designate the second person of the Trinity in contradistinction to the first. Third, monogenes is regularly and systematically understood and deployed to uphold the son's status as true son, as a genuine son. As genuine son, he is genuinely begotten from the father in a way that indicates identity of essence and relation of origin. Thus, the son is begotten without passional parts, excluding adoptive or figural understandings of the second person's sonship. It is precisely at this point that we should understand that a pro-Nicene doctrine of eternal generation does not directly depend on either the five Johannine texts, nor interpreting monogenes upon strictly only begotten generational lines. Eternal generation emerges as a corollary of the Son being truly Son of the Father, eternally Son of the Father, uniquely Son of the Father. At the same time, and fourthly, even if monogenes is not the ground of that doctrine, it is a strong support for it. The unique status of the Son as God's only child, his only Son, strengthens the pro-Nicene argument that his sonship is unique in kind and cannot be explained away on the basis of other Son texts in Scripture which extend the term to other beings. Nor, as Gregory asserts, is the Homoian trajectory of interpreting monogenes as uniquely created without mediation from a sole source an adequate account of the term theologically or linguistically. Going forward, to insist that monogenes means one of a kind or special without reference to derivation or lack of siblings is to do no better than eunomius and ignore the common meaning of the word. Yet neither can we force the begotten genie back into the monogenes bottle. Only begotten is a theological jargon translation that imports far more than it clarifies. The old argument that eternal generation rests upon a 4th century misunderstanding of monogenes as only begotten is demonstrably then false on three grounds. Pro-Nicene authors are well aware that the term refers to an only child, just as in all other texts. Secondly, Pro-Nicene authors rarely, if ever, develop an explicit exegetical foundation for eternal generation on those five Johannine texts. Thirdly, Pro-Nicene utilization of monogenes supports the genuine, unique sonship of the second person of the Trinity. Thank you.